Good morning, everyone. Just want to share some thoughts with you this morning. Well, I guess every Sunday morning I'm going to share some thoughts with you. Here at Porch Life, I think you have probably noticed that we observe the Lord's Supper every week. Right? There are some churches, the church where I grew up, I think we did it once a quarter. There was a special Sunday once a quarter that was set aside where we would have time for communion. Some churches do it once a month. Here at Porch Life, we observe the Lord's Supper every week. We do it because we remember Jesus giving his life for us on the cross. And, you know, I think we need to be thankful for his sacrifice. Right? But because we are very forgetful, because of that, Jesus understood, and so he commands us to take the bread and cup to help us to remember. Right? He said, do this, what? In remembrance of me. He's helping us. He says, I'm commanding you. I am instituting this sacrament. Do it so that you remember. We forget. We forget, right? And I think the running joke always is, you know, the husband who forgets the anniversary. I've never forgotten. But we forget, right? The Passover, if you remember why the Passover was instituted. The first Passover was instituted so that the Israelites would be prepared spiritually and physically for the journey they were about to face. They were about to flee from Egypt, right? But after that, they were commanded every year at the same time to observe the Passover. Why? Because people are forgetful of God's goodness, right? If you think about what happened with the Israelites, they came out of Egypt, and I should know this, but I don't remember the exact timeline. But within months, or maybe days, they started complaining already. Right? They only had manna, I think. They didn't have, who was it like? They were running out of water, didn't have fresh water, and they complained. They said to Moses, why did you bring us out here to starve and die? Better had we been left back in Egypt. Right? They forgot already 400 years of bondage as slaves. And that's us, right? We are so forgetful. And so the Lord commands us to take the bread and cup so that we would remember. And if nothing else, even if we're not forgetful, oftentimes we're so busy, right? If you look at your lives, and here especially, we live in the Silicon Valley, we're very busy. Where we're constantly distracted by work. Work takes up a lot of our time. We're constantly thinking about it, taking care of family, meeting the needs of the family, emotional, physical, spiritual, all of that. There's so much that's weighing on us. And so we get so distracted that we don't spend the time thinking about the things that we should think about. And so God is kind and God is good. And he says, I'm going to make you do something so that you don't forget the things that you shouldn't forget. Right? It's not God saying, I want you to think about me because it makes me feel good. It's for our own sake. Right? And so today, in speaking of remembering what Jesus did for us on the cross, in light of that, we're going to go through quite a few Bible passages. We're going to look at how the world treated the Messiah that came to save us. Right? We take the bread and cup in remembrance, in hindsight. But we're going to look at that time, as Jesus was walking to the cross, as he was facing death on the cross, how the world treated him. So, we're going to pick up again from where we left off last week in Matthew chapter 6. And as we go through the passages, I'm just going to read through them. You don't have to read it aloud, but follow along in the Bible. Right? There's certain things I want to call out to you as we look through the passages. So, going back to Matthew chapter 26. If you turn there, starting in verse 23, Jesus was having the Passover meal with the disciples, and he answered and he said, he who dipped his hand with me in the dish will betray me. Right? Jesus makes a statement as he was taking that meal with the disciples, and I don't think they knew this yet, but this was going to be his very last meal with them. Jesus said in verse 23, he who dipped his hand with me in the dish will betray me. Right? And the way the table was set up was, you've got 12 people. So there's going to be dishes spread out, and you know, different clusters at, in front of every dish, they will share that dish. And so not everybody was sharing that dish with Jesus. And so it is believed that Judas was one of the people who was sitting either across or next to Jesus. And Jesus said, "He who dips his hand with me will betray me." This is speaking of Judas, but I shared at a Bible study once, and this, don't take this as a theological, doctrinal interpretation. This is just Jason's thoughts. Okay? It's very, the way I see it, when Jesus says, "He who dipped his hand with me in this dish will betray me," I see it as all the disciples. Because they're all sharing with Jesus, right? It may not be that physical dish, but they were all dipping bread with him at that meal. And how would they betray him? They didn't all go sell out Jesus like Judas did. But if you look, speaking of that betrayal, if you look, when you jump down to verse 35, right? Jesus, this was after the dinner, Jesus had said, "All of you are going to be tested, and all of you will stumble because of me." And Jesus, Peter says to him in verse 35, "Even if I have to die with you, I will not deny you." And so said all the other disciples, right? So speaking of all the disciples betraying, here's Peter making a strong statement. "I would die before I deny you." And then in, if you jump down to verse 56, and when Jesus was arrested, after all that happened, this was done so that the scriptures of the prophets might be fulfilled, Jesus said. And so in verse 56, at the end, you see what? Then, what does he say in verse 56? "Then all the disciples forsook him and fled." Right? So in a sense, I think all the disciples did betray Jesus. Right? They had just said, along with Peter, who led them in his bravado, they had just said, "Even if I have to die with you, I will not deny you," said all the disciples. And then they all fled. Right? And so here's Jesus, his closest followers denied him. Now jump down to verse 69. Verse 69. So here, now we're looking at Peter. Jesus has been arrested. He's been taken in. And Peter followed along at a distance. And now verse 69, we see Peter. He's sitting outside in the courtyard. And a servant girl comes to him and says, "You also were with Jesus of Galilee." Right? There's a commotion going on. Jesus has been arrested. And, you know, someone comes and says, "Hey, you're with that guy that's just been arrested. You're with him." And what did he do? Verse 70, "But he denied it before them all." Right there in that courtyard where we know he was there waiting, trying to get warm from the fire. Peter denied knowing Jesus to them all. Verse 72, when someone else called out that Peter was with Jesus. Verse 72, "But again, he denied with an oath." Right? It's getting stronger. First he denied it, then he swore with an oath, "I do not know the man." And then again, somebody says, "You know, the way you talk, and whether it's your accent or you use some words, you sound like one of those guys." Verse 74, how did Peter react? He began to curse and swear. Peter began to curse and swear, saying, "I do not know the man." Right? So here's Peter, the one who says, "I will go with you to the death. I will not deny you." And now he is so vehemently denying Jesus that he's swearing. Right? First he takes an oath and then he swears. He's cursing. Okay? Disciples have fled. Peter's denying Jesus. This is how we're treating the Messiah who's going to save us. Now, skip forward to chapter 27. Chapter 27. Now we see Jesus brought before Pilate, and he was being tried, and Pilate could find nothing wrong with Jesus. And so, if you understood the tradition of the time, the governor would say, "Look, here's Jesus, he's on trial, and here is another criminal, Barabbas, who was a murderer and a thief, right? Today, I can release to you one of these prisoners." And he's hoping against hope that the people would choose Jesus. Because look, the other guy, Barabbas, is a murderer. He's killed somebody. He's taken someone's life. Jesus, they're trying to prove that he did something wrong, and they were having trouble proving that he's actually done something wrong. And so the governor's thinking, look, clear choice here, right? it would be akin to someone who killed a person and someone who said something bad about you. Who do you want released to you? Which prisoner do you want released? Look what the people said. In chapter 27, verse 21, the governor answered and said to them, "Which of the two do you want me to release to you?" They said, "Barabbas, the murderer." Okay? Pilate said to them, "What then shall I do with Jesus who is called Christ?" What do I, you want Barabbas, it's fine. What do I do with this guy who by law is innocent, who hasn't done anything wrong? They all said to him, "Let him be crucified." Right? This is the masses. Right? Imagine Jesus standing there. He's looking out. These are the people that he came to save. Not just them, all of us too, but he's looking there at the people he came to save, and they are crying out, "Put this guy on the cross." Right? Not only that, so verse 23, the governor said, "Why? Why crucify him? What evil has he done?" And look at the people. Look at how they reacted. But they what? They cried out all the more. It's almost like something was inside them, stirring them. Right? They were getting agitated now. They cried out all the more. "Let him be crucified." And so Pilate saw that he couldn't do anything about this. He wasn't able to convince the crowds. And so, and there was an uprising now, right? People were starting to revolt. And he wants to keep things under control. And so he does this. This is, I believe, where the phrase comes from, washing your hands of the deed. He took some water and he washed his hands and he said, "I have nothing to do with this decision. You're the ones asking for Jesus, an innocent man, to be crucified. I will give you what you want, but I don't approve of this decision." So he washes his hands, saying, "I am innocent of the blood of this just person. He's done nothing wrong. He's done no evil. But you are demanding his blood. You will have it, but it's not on me. You see to it." Okay? Verse 25. This scares me. Verse 25. "And all the people answered and said, 'His blood be on us and on our children.'" Right? When people do something bad and when they're stirred up, a lot of times they'll say, "You know what? I don't care. I will deal with responsibilities." But I think it takes a certain kind of insanity, almost, a psychosis, to be able to say, "And my children will bear that responsibility." Right? If anything, as parents, we, you know, I don't know, those of us that are parents here, we may go to extreme lengths to take care of our kids, to protect them, to shelter them. We may even do, you know, some things that are borderline not great to help them. But we would never say, "Whatever I do, put the responsibility on them too." And so the people were so stirred up that they said, "This innocent man's blood, let it be on us and on our children." That's how much they wanted to see Jesus dead. Right? And so again, put yourself in Jesus' shoes. You're here to save humanity. And yet here they are in front of you, crying out for your death. Right? Well, I almost imagine a picture of this crowd foaming at the mouth. Right? It's sad. Right? Then, as if that's not enough, the soldiers take him and they start to beat him. They put a robe on him. And if you look, chapter 27, at the end of verse 29, what did these soldiers do? They bowed the knee before him, right? Instead of just outright hurting him, they bowed before him and mocked him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews." I think if I were in Jesus' shoes, I would rather take the direct punches. Spit on me, right? Hit me, hurt me. But this hurts all the more where people now pretend to get down on, they do get down on their knees, but they're pretending to worship you. Right? Then they're pretending and they're saying, "Hail, King of the Jews." And so they're mocking him. Right? This is what the soldiers are doing. Then skip down to verse 38. Jesus has been put on the cross. Next to him, on two other crosses, were two robbers, one on the right and one on the left. And so they're crucified, not dead yet, right? Verse 39, all those who passed by blasphemed him. Right? Again, Jesus is now, hanging on the cross, he has begun that process of dying for these very people. And as they walked by, right? Imagine this scene. Jesus hanging on the cross. Number one, it's gruesome. Number two, it's solemn. Right? But here's people just strolling by like they're walking past a supermarket. And they're looking at him and they blaspheme him and they're wagging their heads. Right? Verse 40, "You who destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself. If you are the Son of God, come down from the cross." Right? The mockery that they throw on him. Okay? Verse 41, "Likewise, the chief priests also, mocking with the scribes and elders, said, 'He saved others, himself he cannot save.'" Again, they're just piling on insults and mockery. This is no way to treat just a man, no way to treat a just man, an innocent man, and yet they, you know, look at all they're doing to him. Verse 44, "Even the robbers who were crucified with him reviled him with the same thing." Right? And so today, the message this morning, the title I gave it was "The Weight of the Cross." Right? When you think about what Jesus bore, not just on the cross, but on the way to the cross, right? The physical suffering, we would never forget the physical suffering. It was excruciating. He hung on that cross for 3 hours. Think about that. 3 hours. Our service here is only an hour long. If I told you to hold out your hands like this, just during the whole service, you know, not no nails, nothing, just hold out your hands for an hour. Good luck. After 2 minutes, I think you would start to get sore. If you're working out and doing something a lot, maybe you're a little stronger, 5 minutes. Right? 3 hours, Jesus endured physical suffering on that cross. He endured not being able to breathe. He endured the nails that were in his hands, ripping through the flesh because his weight's hanging on there. He endured the nails in his feet and all the weight pressing down on that, right? He endured all this for 3 hours. And yes, so never, ever forget the excruciating physical suffering that he went through. But think about the insults that were heaped on him as he went to the cross, on the way to the cross, and as he hung on that cross. You come to save us? Save yourself. Get down from there. Right? And imagine the people, the very people you came to save, saying these things to you. Right? Look, I mean, you know, I like to think I'm a pretty nice guy. But if I were helping you, well, let's say, you know, you're asking for help to move some furniture, and I'm helping you, and you're standing on the side, "Dude, you're so weak, you know? Move faster. What's taking you so long?" I would just drop the couch and leave, you know? Help yourself, right? Jesus was big. I mean, this is magnitudes more of what Jesus is doing. And people were heaping insults on him. And as if all this hate from the people that he came to save being thrown on him, as if that wasn't enough. Verse 45. "Now, from the sixth hour until the ninth hour, there was darkness over all the land. And about the ninth hour," this is the end, "about the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, saying, 'Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani,' that is, 'My God, why have you forsaken me?'" And then in verse 50, "Jesus cried out again with a loud voice and yielded up his spirit." On top of all the physical suffering, on top of the very people that he came to die for mocking him, here we see God the Father forsaking him. And what does it mean? What does it mean to be forsaken by God? In this moment when Jesus cried out, he had, and I don't understand how this works, but he had all the sins of the world, before, present, and future, on him. He bore that sin on our behalf. We remember, those of you that were in Bible study, we were talking about sacrifice, right? And Jesus starting this new covenant with us. The new covenant being you no longer have to sacrifice an animal each time you sin. Now Jesus died once and for all. Well, the reason he died once and for all and he doesn't have to die every time is because he took all your sins. Even the sins that you're going to commit next week. Think about that. It's mind-boggling. The sins that you're going to commit next week, and I know there are some, those sins 2,000 years ago, he already died for them. Time travel? No. This is how God works, outside of time. The sins that you have yet to commit, Jesus already died for them, so that once and for all, the atonement was made. But in that moment, with all the world's sin on him, God the Father looked down on Jesus and he saw filth, the filth of the sin. And so God the Father could not be in communion with Jesus. And so we know that God the Father, in that moment, turned his back on Jesus. And you have to picture, this is Jesus Christ, the Son of God, who since he was little, since he was born, walked in the presence of the Lord. He had constant communion with God the Father. He said this. He said as much. I do nothing except what the Father tells me to do. I say nothing except what the Father tells me to say. The works I do are my Father's work. He was... Okay, this might be kind of weird, but it was like a spiritual umbilical cord that was never cut. He's constantly, think about that, constantly in communion with the Father. Never having been separated from God the Father. Right? Think about, I don't know if you've ever seen those old-fashioned diving suits. Right? Technology has come a long way. We've got people who have scuba tanks and they dive and do all these crazy things. But back in the day, when they first started these diving suits, they were these huge suits and had a big, heavy metal helmet. You've seen those, right? And it looks like there's a little grate, a little window in the front. And then there's a tube that comes out of it. Where does that tube go? Up to the surface, up to the ship. And so you could only dive as far as that tube went. And that tube, what did it give you? Air. You needed air to survive, and as you're diving in these old-fashioned suits, there's that tube, right? That's your life. That's Jesus' connection with God the Father. He had that living connection with God the Father that sustained him for all these 33 and a half years, and in this moment, cut. Imagine yourself as a diver, and that tube is cut. Right? The anxiety. I don't think anxiety is the right word that we would describe it here. Jesus, in that moment, his literal lifeline from God the Father was cut. Imagine what he's going through. Why, my God, why have you forsaken me? Because Jesus did no wrong. Right? He obeyed the Father perfectly. Up to this moment, and including this moment. This moment came only because Jesus obeyed God the Father perfectly. Why have you forsaken me, God? I'm doing what you asked me to do. But it wasn't a why to contest the will of God. It wasn't to question God, it was to express the anguish that was felt within Jesus. The temptation in the desert, being without food for 40 days and nights, that was tough. Having people mock him and hate him, wanting to kill him, that's hard. But I do believe the hardest thing, even harder than those 3 hours hanging there bleeding and not being able to breathe, even harder than all that was this moment, God the Father severing that tie with him. The pain that was in Jesus came out and when he said, my God, why have you forsaken me? Right? And so here's Jesus. He's separated. Look, I think we should understand this as well in our souls. Right? We were created for the sole purpose of worshiping God. That's what mankind was made for, to fellowship with God and to worship Him. And so when sin is in our life and we are separated from God, I think all of us feel to some degree that unwellness that is within us when things are not right with God. But we were born sinners. Imagine for Jesus what it was like all his life to have never been separated from God. To have that cut. And yet, despite all this, right? And as Jesus hung there, and look, in that distress when he said, "Why have you forsaken me?" He didn't question God, because we see in verse 50, he cried out again with a loud voice, and what did he do? He yielded up his spirit. Right? So we see up until the point of his death, he didn't fight it. Right? It wasn't Jesus there, "Don't let me die, God. No, they're taking..." No, he yielded. He said, "It is done, Father. What you have set me to do on this cross," as he hung there, he said, "It is done," and he yielded his spirit. Why is it important that we see that he yielded his spirit? What did Jesus say? "My life, I lay down my life. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down myself." So that moment when he died, he gave his life up. Right? It wasn't that death had victory over Jesus. Jesus willingly yielded his spirit up to God the Father. And he does this, again, in perfect obedience to God the Father. And he does this at that moment when he yielded his life, his spirit. He did it for you. For you, for you, each of you. I know you're not looking at me, I'm pointing at you, but he did it for each and every one of us. He did it for me. And so it brings us back then to chapter 26. If you remember that scene before when Jesus and his disciples were observing the Passover, turn back to Matthew 26, verse 26. We looked at this last week, but I want to look at it again. Why? Because as they were eating, Jesus took bread, right, in full view of what was going to happen. Jesus knew already what was going to happen on the cross. Right? If you remember when Mary poured out that oil on Jesus' head, what did he say? Wherever this gospel is preached, what this woman has did will be told as a memorial to her. So he already knows. Jesus prophesied, because he already knows he will die, he will rise again, and the gospel will be preached. Right? So in full view of everything that was going to happen over the next 3-4 days, in verse 26, as they were eating, Jesus took the bread. He took the bread, blessed it and broke it, and gave it to the disciples and said, "Take, eat, this is my body. I am going to be broken for you, for the world, for all who have sinned. Take this bread and remember my body broken for you." And he took that bread and he broke it and gave it to them. Verse 27, "Then he took the cup and gave thanks and gave it to them, saying, 'Drink from it, all of you, for this is my blood of the new covenant.'" Remember that new covenant, once and for all, "which is shed for many for the remission of sins." Right? So looking ahead to what was going to happen on the cross, where his body would be broken and his blood would be shed for us, Jesus institutes, commands the Lord's Supper. And he says, "This is my body. It's broken for your sake. Take it in remembrance of me. This is my blood that was poured out for the remission, for the washing away of sins. As you drink it, remember me." And look, when we celebrate and observe the Lord's Supper every week, we don't do it as a mere ritual. We don't do it as a repetition. We don't do it because somebody somewhere along the line said, "If you want to be part of this church system, you have to do it." That's not the why. The why is that we always, always, always remember what Jesus did for us on the cross, what he endured for our sake. Those insults that were hurled at him. Look, when we sin, we're right along with those people, insulting them. Right? But we want to remember, and I pray, as we take the Lord's Supper week after week after week, that it never gets old. And I say this because I understand, I am also a human being. When you do something week after week, there is that tendency of forgetting why you do it. It becomes just a habit, right? When you're married, when you say, I love you, honey, walking out the door, sometimes it's just an easy thing to just say, right? And it becomes an easy phrase that just comes out of your mouth, and you don't make me think about what you're saying. In the same way, I want us to think about what we're doing when we come and take the Lord's cup and we take the bread that is His body. I want us to remember that this, we'll be singing this morning, right? His body, the bread, His blood, the wine, broken and poured out all for love. This love so amazing, right? And look, as a church, I want us to grow in all ways. I want us to grow in our love for the Word of God, which is why every week I'm sending out reminders. Come to Bible study. Love the Word of God as we come together and study it. I want us to grow in our desire to pray together. So every week, come, pray with us on Wednesday nights. And to entice you to come, we'll make dinner. Right? Gather together. Don't forsake gathering together here on Sundays to worship together. Because worship is good. It is a weapon that we use against the power of evil. And yes, like Peter said this morning, as God loved us, so we should love others. Go out and love other people. Go out and bring the gospel to all the nations. We want to do all that as a church, and I want us to grow in that respect. But for all of that to happen, for all that to happen naturally, to grow naturally, I think it all starts right here. It all starts right here when we come back to the bread and cup and we remember, what did you do for me, Jesus? Why are we here? Why do we bother getting together once a week? You know, it takes work, right? Every week we come in here, and I'm thankful for all the help that you guys do, coming in and setting up and tearing down. Yeah, there's work involved in meeting here. Why? Why do we do it? It comes back to this, the bread and the cup. Remembering what Jesus did on the cross, right? Once we come back to this, once we start with this in remembering what Jesus did, then our response trickles down into everything else that we do. And it fills and motivates everything that we do. Why would I not love coming together with the saints to study His Word? I want to know what Jesus said. Why wouldn't I? He died for me on the cross. I want to get together and pray for each other and for the church. Why? Because I love talking to God. He died for me on the cross. I love to worship my mouth. I love to open my mouth and worship on Sundays. Why? Because He's worthy of it. Because He died for me on the cross. I want to come and hear what there is to learn from God's Word. Why? Because He died for me on the cross. So it all starts here. Then everything else that we want to do, why would I go and tell someone else about Jesus? Because He died for me on the cross. Why wouldn't I? It all starts here. And so I really encourage us this morning during the bread and cup, as Peter leads us in worship again, to meditate on what Jesus did. Don't let this become just another thing that we do on Sundays. Think on it. Think on it deeply. Meditate on what Jesus did. And when, okay, look, I'm not sitting there with a name list. Okay, who prayed this Sunday for bread and cup, who didn't, right? That in and of itself doesn't matter to me. What I would like is for all of us, every single one of us, hopefully, I hope, I pray, that every single one, old and young, that every single one of us would take time in prayer to say, Jesus, thank you. Thank you for what you endured on my behalf. Thank you for what you did on the cross for me. On that note, Peter, would you please come? and lead us in the Lord's Supper.